For them, the wall and white nationalism is paramount. So if people think this is an aberration, they're wrong. And I think what we're going to witness is a more radicalized version of this fear-mongering, especially against people of color.
Yo, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa. It's still 2019. It's still 2019.
2019 just started, Maria. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Joining us from Washington, D.C. is a first-timer on In the Thick. We're so happy to have Van Newkirk, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic. Hey, Van, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. And joining us also from Washington, D.C. is an all-star, Wajahat Ali, a contributor to The New York Times and a man of many other things. Hey, Waj, welcome back to the show. Happy New Year.
Maria, Happy New Year to you and to Julio.
Hey, and Happy New Year to your parents, Waj. That's a direct from Maria Hinojosa to Waj.
Yes, because my parents are Maria's biggest fans, let it be known. And each time I come on the show, they have finally discovered, Maria, and they're like, do you know this Maria? She's excellent. And I'm like, I kind of know her.
Awesome.
They see you on MSNBC, and she goes, she's very smart. You should be friends with this Maria. And I'm like, I'm going to look into that. So there you go.
All right. So while Waj is busy looking into new friends to make, we're going to talk about the shutdown. Okay. So, wow. It's a partial government shutdown going into its third week. It is on its way to breaking the record to become the longest government shutdown in history. Trump threatened that it could last for months or even years. This is Trump when he was answering questions from reporters at a briefing on Friday.
Have you considered using emergency powers to grant yourself authorities to build this wall without congressional approval?
Yes, I have. And I can do it if I want.
So you don't need congressional approval to build the wall?
No, we can use them. Absolutely. We can call a national emergency because of the security of our country. Absolutely. No, we can do it. I haven't done it. I may do it.
Okay, so actually, a national emergency is only declared during wartime President of the United States, Trump. He did spend the entire weekend tweeting away. But, you know, the thing is that those tweets, while we can kind of decide not to pay attention, they are how he gets his base revved up. Monday, the negotiations continued. You know, meanwhile, over 800,000 federal employees across the country are not getting paid. Veterans are going without services. You've got food aid programs that have closed down. We're talking about people actually, you know, hungry. Like, this is for real. So, Waj, are you like, what, is your head exploding? I mean, this national emergency strategy, and like, what about the Democrats? What do you think about their response?
Yeah, so no, I predicted this. I was talking to Van about this before we started, and about 2 weeks ago, I said he's going to break the record that was set in 1995 in the Clinton administration. That was 21 days. And I said he's predictable because, you know, Donald Trump caters to his base. And if you remember the 2018 midterm elections, even though he had unemployment at 3.7%, what did he decide to double, triple down on? The caravan, right? And now he's going to go visit the border and he's going to force Mexico to pay for this wall. And he called it a humanitarian crisis and a national security crisis. Well, just one fact, there is no crisis at the border, Maria. And I always want to keep repeating that with as many outlets as I can, because the number of detentions of migrants has gone down. Like, there's 80% less apprehensions, right? There's less border crossings, illegal border crossings, because most people overstay their visa. That means they fly over here. And people who come from foreign countries have less criminal history than people who are born in this country, right? So there's no crisis. There's no border crisis. And the humanitarian crisis, guys, as we know, is very real, caused by the Trump administration and their detention and separation of families. So I think for the Democrats, and I hate saying this, strategically, it's in their benefit for him to prolong this, because he has owned it like a reckless moron on television. He said it's his shutdown, and people are not increasingly for the wall. And as you mentioned, 800,000 federal workers are going to be without pay. Guess what? Everyone likes to eat, including Republicans and Democrats. So this goes on another week or two. There's going to be a march in Washington of federal workers who are going to say, open up the damn government. We don't want this damn wall. And it's going to hurt Trump, in my opinion.
Van.
Yeah.
What do you think?
So, I mean, I think the point about there's going to be 800,000 angry federal employees, that's about right. But also, it's not just federal employees who are going to be feeling this, who are feeling the squeeze right now. You got people who are going to not be able to afford food very soon. You're going to have people who are not going to be able to afford their rent because housing and urban development grants and subsidized housing vouchers aren't going to be able to go through soon. So what do you have? You have lots of people in and around D.C. who are living in subsidized housing who are not going to be able to pay their rents. You have federal employees who are not going to be able to eat, have their families eat. You have people who are in daycare centers in D.C. Lots of people don't know. Lots of them are subsidized by the USDA and HUD. And so when that funding goes away, you have lots of people now who cannot eat, who cannot pay for their rent, who cannot have child care for their kids.
Ugh.
And what do you think that's going to do for Donald Trump? That's not something that I don't think he can win.
I mean, it sounds so scary the way you lay it out, but we need to hear it like that. Like, no child care, no paycheck, no way to pay your rent. I mean, ay Dios. And these 800,000 workers, by the way, they're spread out in many of the states
right.
that Donald Trump won.
Can we put a number on that? There's going to be 38 million low-income people who are going to be affected when food stamp budget runs out. That's 38 million.
But you know what? I want to tell you guys just two ways, and I'm not a federal worker, as you know, but two ways in which this shutdown is impacting me. And you're like, what?
Yeah, what?
One is that I have a couple of Freedom of Information Act requests that are pending that on investigations that Latino USA is working on. We're not going to get a response. It's a way in which Freedom of Information Act requests just go into a black hole. And I'm trying to do some paperwork regarding my citizenship. And so USCIS, goodbye. I mean, there's no way to get basic questions answered, to get an appointment. If it was hard before there was a government shutdown. And this is something that I'm doing just like, you know, kind of a la carte. It's not an urgent thing. For people who are dealing with immigration urgently, this government shutdown is having an impact on them.
Right. And I want to kind of go back on the question about the Democrats handling this. And I want to ask this specifically to Van. Are they just like, let's just sit it out? Like, this is a big standoff and we're just going to wait? I mean, do you think like that's going to play more into Democrats' hands? Or do you think like, once people are out on the streets, both parties are to blame?
I don't know if I see much movement toward the both parties are to blame narrative. I think most people understand that this is about the president's desire for the wall. And that's Democrats don't have to spend a whole lot of time getting the basic messaging out. What I've seen and what I think will be the case is that basically, look, you're not going to be able to get milk for your kid in school, and it's because of Trump.
Right.
They have an easy message right there. That, you know, they can say you can't pay your rent because of Trump. And the longer it goes on, the easier it is to drill that message in. He's going down to the southern border. He's going to be talking about the wall. He's hoping that the more he can bang that drum, he can shore up enough support to weather it. But I just don't know that people are responding to that message the same way they were even in the midterm in 2018. You get diminishing returns every time.
And also last week under Pelosi's leadership, you know, Julio, the Democrats actually passed a bill that got bipartisan support that would actually fund these agencies up until August and also has a stopgap measure to fund DHS up until February. So like they're like, hey, guys, we gave you like $1.6 billion for the wall, and we actually have bipartisan support to actually keep the government running. Here you go, Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, like Van said, nope. I want the beautiful steel slats. Give me the steel slats.
And there it is. There's the Wajahat Ali Trump impersonation, which I love.
Thank you.
And for measure, that's actually a bill that was already passed in the Senate just a couple of weeks before we were talking about the shutdown. But to focus back on this obsession with the wall. And surprise, surprise, of course, this entire shutdown, it all hinges on immigration policy and Trump's sort of obsessive push for this flipping border wall. So on Sunday, the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she went on Fox News and host Chris Wallace of Fox News Sunday fact-checked and challenged her.
We know that roughly nearly 4,000 known or suspected terrorists come into our country illegally. And we know that our most vulnerable point of entry is at our southern border.
Because I know this statistic. I didn't know if you were going to use it, but I studied up on this. Do you know where those 4,000 people come or where they're captured? Airports.
Not always, but certainly a large
number. The State Department says there hasn't been any terrorists that they found coming across the southern border from
Mexico. It's by air, it's by land, and it's by sea. It's all of the above. But one thing that you're forgetting is that the most vulnerable point of entry that we have into this country is our southern border.
Ay, Dios mío. I studied up on this. Well, thank you, Chris Wallace, for doing your job.
And this just literally proves the point I made on Friday for our ITT sound off, that the media is fact-checking this propaganda, these lies, after the fact, when we should be challenging it the moment the president says it.
Right.
Right. And so the Washington Post basically says, look, it's not 4,000, it's 3,755. It doesn't refer to terrorists caught at airports, but to known or suspected terrorists prevented from traveling to or entering the United States, as per a document released by the Department of Homeland Security on Friday. Hello. In other words, basically, so if somebody's on that list who may have no association with terrorism at all, but they tried to get on a flight in London to get to the United States, they were probably prevented from getting on that flight. And that person counts in that 3,755 figure. So it's basically, let's see, how do we put it? Making shit up.
Yeah.
Yes, it's making shit up, and we're allowing for the shit to be told, and then we're questioning the shit. And okay, so I just had to let that one go.
No, you can't, because I don't think you should let it go, because also another one is the Department of Justice admitted that they messed up in their numbers last week about the number of quote-unquote terrorists. And then once they were, like, you know, outed, they refused to update or correct their own numbers.
Damn. Oh, God.
So the Department of Justice under Donald Trump has actually erroneously, essentially has very deliberately misled the American public about these alleged terrorists. And once they got called out for it, they have refused to correct their numbers. That's just something that, you know, I want people to kind of just sit with for like a second. And when they talk about this humanitarian crisis and national security crisis and border security crisis, they are lying. And the one thing, Julio, I think is you have every right to be upset, because can you imagine if reporters and journalists actually did this to Trump for the past 3 years, like fact-checked him live?
Right. And that's the point I want to ask Van about, you know, all this fabricating of facts. You see it. We're seeing it daily. But then you see like Chris Wallace suddenly like challenging it. So are we starting to see the early signs of a change, or is this just like a crazy exception?
Oh, what a wonder it is for journalists to start actually doing it again.
Thank you. I love you, Van.
That's a very simple, I mean, it didn't have to study a whole lot to figure this out. This wasn't like some arcane fact. It was clear Sanders was going to bring this point up. Everybody who was setting that interview up knew it. And you had it teed up automatically. This is what any journalist should be doing whenever they get an official communication from the administration. And it should be our job always. Whenever we get something, we question it. And that's what we pay journalists to do. All of the facts and the data in front of us show that this is actually the most difficult it's ever been to enter the United States in any fashion.
Right.
And we regularly apprehend and reject people who aren't actually terrorists. And that's what that report from Homeland Security shows us.
Right.
And it's being spun, and it's clearly being spun. And any journalist worth their salt, I don't care what side of this political spectrum you're on.
Exactly.
If you take that report and you take what they are telling you and don't question it, I just don't know what I can call you. What are you? You're not a journalist.
You're a stenographer.
You are
propagandist.
So, you know, this is, of course, one of the, excuse me, raison d'être. Just to show my French. This is one of the raison d'être of our show, right? Is, in fact, to say that the role of the journalist is, yes, to report, to get the facts, but our role is also to shine light. Our role is also to question authority and challenge authority. And our role is not always to say that there are both sides to the argument, because that would mean it would be like basically any mainstream news organization like the New York Times, like having, you know, on one day of their op-ed, like a pro-Hitler, pro-Nazi op-ed, and the next day You know, having an anti-Nazi, anti-Hitler op-ed. I mean, I didn't read the op-ed pages from the 1940s. I don't think that they were doing, but that's basically what this equivalency would look like.
Yep.
And so we're watching this notion of the journalists and both sides when they're saying, one, when they're beginning to blame, like, let's just say the Democrats, you know, in the case of the government shutdown. Well, isn't it really your fault? When it's just like, okay, that's ridiculous. And two,
yeah,
on this question of the border security and the fact that it's total bullshit. And I have one last thing to say, because I'm going to bring up his name. It's a dude who used to be around a year ago. I don't forget so quickly. But, you know, with the government shutdown, just to finish on that, you know, I'm not surprised that Trump is enjoying this. It was Steve Bannon who said, bring it all down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crush it all down. Destroy it all.
Yeah, he called himself a Leninist. He said, I'm a Leninist. I want to bring it all down. That was his quote.
I'm just saying. Anyway, last thoughts on these on this topic from our two guests, Waj and Van.
Look, you should have taken Hitler literally and seriously. yes, thank you for that callback, man. I appreciate that. And, you know, and I take Trump literally and seriously as one of the, you know, person of color journalists who follow the campaign. And, you know, we've been doing this for a while now.
Yeah.
You should see the people he surrounds himself with. Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon, Jeff Sessions. They're not subtle. They've never been subtle about their agenda, especially when it comes to immigration, especially when it comes to people of color. This is all very predictable. So it's going to get worse. They're going to double down on this. And Donald Trump is now, his Jiminy Cricket is Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh. And for them, the wall and white nationalism is paramount. So if people think this is an aberration, they're wrong. And if they think they're going to back down, they're wrong. And I think what we're going to witness as the years go on, even though it might be a minority, I hope, is a more radicalized version of this fear-mongering, especially against people of color and immigrants. Just something to take into consideration. This is not going to go away anytime soon. And the Overton window of what's acceptable in conversation has shifted. And this is what we have to deal with.
First of all, you mentioned a very famous piece from TheAtlantic.com on taking Trump seriously. Well, not literally. But
Van.
Yeah, yeah. But over the past, you know, couple decades, I think maybe since the civil rights movement, mass media has existed basically to, it's moved the bounds of discourse to fit everything both parties say into what's acceptable. So if something happens that's unacceptable, media stretches in order to make it so it can fit. And I think we are running up against the limits of that what we were before. But now we're running up against news organizations are going to have to decide, are we going to continue this closing our eyes and pretending that false equivalences are the same thing as nonpartisanship? Or are we actually going to start getting real information in front of our viewers? And I think viewers are actually going to come to a point where they're going to decide what they want and what they are demanding from the media organization. So the border, not crisis, the language around it, the wall, the pure, unadulterated disinformation coming on that, I think it's going to put a lot of newsrooms in a crisis moment, and maybe it's a good crisis.
Good test for America.
Hey, we're back, and you're listening to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa with my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. We're joined by Waja Harali and Van Newkirk, and we're going to jump right back to our conversation. And the next topic is the presidential election of 2020 that has already started. 2020 presidential election preview. It's for real. I have been saying for a while, like to my husband, that I think it was going to be a Biden-Beto ticket, even though I have there's a lot of criticism around Biden that I've heard. And not so much around Beto at all. But I didn't realize that now it's like really becoming a thing, right? And so I did say that's what this country can handle right now is a white man and a white man. So what are you thinking in terms of 2020? Let's start with you, Waj. When you start hearing about this, the possible lineups, what's going on for you?
So Joe Biden on Sunday said, allegedly, according to the New York Times, that he believes he represents the Democrats' best hope for actually taking on Trump and winning. So to kind of be a Biden propagandist for a second, Well, according to the latest polls, he's running him number one. You know, and that field is very rich. It has Warren, it has Sanders, it has Kamala Harris, Cory Booker. Number two, he can get you the Rust Belt. He'll get you Pennsylvania. He'll get you probably Wisconsin, right? And let's not forget that Donald Trump only won based off of about 78,000 votes off of three states. Now, Biden is 76 and he's going to turn 78 in 2020. Also, Biden, to a lot of people of color and to a lot of women, has a troubling history.
Very, very troubling history.
1994, right? The violence act that he shepherded and he was so proud of. Three strikes.
Also,
you're out.
Anita Hill.
And exactly what I was going to say with Anita Hill, which he now apologizes for, but that's going to come back up. But secondly, he represents something to many people that is not forward. It's not progressive. It's the old guard, literally and figuratively. If it's Biden, I think he'll need, and I hate talking like this, strategically, he will need, I think, a Kamala Harris. So it's going to be Biden-Harris, because you're not going to animate women or people of color in the South if it's just, say, Biden or Beto. Perhaps something which is more galvanizing for the young progressive crowd would be like a Beto-Kamala ticket or even a Warren-Beto ticket. And I think people are kind of writing off Warren. I don't think they should, because a lot of people came out for her in Iowa over the weekend.
Yeah, I think it's a toss-up.
So my thing is, it's a brand new ball game. It's a brave new world. I don't think Biden should rest on his laurels. A lot could happen in 2 years. But I do think you need a combination of a woman in there and preferably a person of color. I think two white dudes is not going to make it work, my opinion.
Ben, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. Two white dudes will get it done. Actually, I think a lot of the conventional wisdom about how to win a Democratic primary and also how to be electable as a Democrat in general will maybe be tested or upended over the next couple months. Looking back at the returns from 2018, looking at some places where Democrats even lost in 2018, Georgia, Florida, Texas, you look at Doug Jones's seat in Alabama. These are states where I think Democrats can take two of the big Southern states.
Oh, yeah.
They can take two with the right candidate. And that changes the math quite a bit. Let's say Florida and Georgia, the two easiest, I believe.
Yeah.
Two easiest ones are Florida and Georgia. If those are on the table, you don't need to sweep the Rust Belt. You don't need a candidate who's going to be able to galvanize West Virginia, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania altogether. You can lean more on a progressive, younger, perhaps person of color as your leader. And maybe I think that filters down to the primary. The primary, it's been the case for the last few Democratic primaries. The South is more and more important in those primaries because, I mean, it's just geographically, demographically, that's where Democratic voters are in numbers. And more people are moving to the South. It's getting browner and blacker.
Right.
And you're going to have a situation for the last four or five presidential elections. The mismatch between the Democratic primary and the general have been just massive in terms of where your delegates come from and where your electors come from. I think it's going to be bigger in 2020, and that's going to warp what Democrats are going to have to promise for the voters in the primary versus what they're going to have to run on in the general. And I think there's space for somebody like it's going to give Beto a little bit bigger of a chance. It's going to, I think, diminish some of Biden's some of the glow to him as he imagined Joe Biden trying to campaign in South Carolina on some of the stuff. His best bet to me, I think, is running as the Obama legacy, which is going to be tough because there's going to be a lot of people. There's going to be a lot of black people on the field who can say, actually, no, you know, I've been talking to Obama. I've been doing these policies. I'm black. You vote for me in South Carolina. It's going to be tough for him, I think, in the South. And I'm looking at from South Carolina to Texas in this primary and really drilling down on who's coming out and
you need black people.
Who's appealing. You need black people and more there in the South.
Yeah, but we just spent like the first part of this conversation talking about a border wall and immigration enforcement and what the wall represents. And Maria and I talk about it all the time. And I have yet to hear like any Latino candidate being named or even being considered, even though, you know, we want to talk about, just want to mention the candidacy of Julian Castro, former San Antonio mayor. He launched his exploratory committee. He's making a big announcement on Saturday, later this week in San Antonio. Marie and I, you know, we know him. I've met him. I've interviewed him. A mutual friend of ours, Roberto Lovato,
oh boy,
questions his entire passion.
Here's what happened is this week from ABC put out a clip of Julian Castro saying,
I'm not going to be a single issue candidate if I run. I believe that what we need for America to prosper in the 21st century is a strong vision for the country's future. And so my vision for the country's future is that we aim in the 21st century to be the smartest, the healthiest, the most fair, and the most prosperous country.
To which Roberto Lovato replied and said, not true. He said, Castro definitely has a single issue focus, being hella boring.
Oh, wow.
So that's a question I have for you, Van, because you...
Are you asking Van if Julian Castro is hella boring?
No,
that's like putting a lot on Van. But Van, the truth is that there is something about passion, and the truth is that... There is a real lack of passion there. And I guess, I'm sorry, totally interrupted you, Julio, but I guess the question to Van is, how important is that? That passion, that fire, that thing.
Right, but how important is it also being Latino? Because to be honest with you, the number one campaign issue,
you know it, Van, you know it, Waj, you know it, Maria,
the number one campaign issue that Donald Trump's going to do in his reelection is about the friggin' border wall and about the invasion.
Yeah.
So, Van, I mean, what are your thoughts? I mean, do we need to see a high-profile Latino candidate in this discussion or not?
I mean, I think we do. It's past time. Mm. It's far past time for us to have serious Latino candidates in the primaries, in the general. And I think it's my stance on diversifying the field generally. The more you get in the door in the first place, the better chances you have of that going on in the end. You can't start out with a bunch of white guys and expect not to have a white guy, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's actually a couple ways Castro's candidacy gets a boost here, and one of them's happening right now. We just talked about it. The fact that lots of people are not going to be able to pay their rent. You got the former secretary of the HUD who's coming and basically going to able to... I think housing is going to be one of those shadow issues that really comes up and becomes suddenly important, especially as the economic signs aren't looking too great.
Especially in the Northeast.
Right. In the Northeast, rents are going up. Foreclosures appear to be creeping back up. We don't really have a strong housing market. And whether it collapses or not, you got lots of people who were promised affordable housing and don't have it. It seems to me he can be a two-issue candidate. He can go and really get into that piece. Again, you know, this is going to be, if you're trying to game theory this out, you're going to have a 25-person field at the end of this summer. I can't predict who the hell's going to win where, who's going to pick up which super delegates.
Right.
The whole entire process is different now because of the Unity Commission has changed things. Who the hell knows who's going to be around by next spring? And you know, I think anything's possible.
But he's not going to be Castro. He's not going to be around.
Yikes.
It's not, okay, not going to happen.
I was going to say that it was Wajahat Ali who said that.
Yeah. Waj, so what up? What do you think?
It's a throwback to the conversation we were talking about in the first segment about what Democrats can do. Is exactly, you're right, Julio, is that immigration is something that they want to keep punting. Decade after decade. And it's something now that here we go. This is the test for America. Democrats now have an opportunity right now and leading up to 2020 to give their comprehensive vision of immigration reform. They have to be bold about it. They have to be open about it. They have to be transparent about it. And they need the right messengers. So that's number one. Number two, I think let's see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. America is okay with the Latinos and the Puerto Ricans. In fact, they find her to be adorable and charismatic, and they bring her on 60 Minutes, and they sit there and go, 70% taxes on the rich. I didn't think about that. Oh, Eisenhower did it. Oh, she's not crazy. And so the likability factor of Latinos, the mainstreaming factor of Latinos, the fact that just over the weekend they said that Latin music has surpassed country music in America,
yes.
Right?
I play some J Balvin because of that.
What I'm saying is this is something that Democrats really need to embrace in a non-tokenized manner and really pay attention to the electorate, the demographics in America, and also put in credible messengers. The only problem with Castro is, like you said, is I don't think the passion's there. I don't think he's a bad person. Like I said, he has the experience as mayor of San Antonio and also as a HUD secretary. But you need that passion and that vitality.
Yeah.
And you need a different messenger. And it'd be great to see a Latin American individual with that experience and that passion, like a Cortez. And I think America's ready for it.
Well, this is why we need to get rid of the 35-year-old threshold, right? Because you have
that's true.
Cortez. And right now,
if you want Latinos, are going to be young.
Because AOC would be running for president. We know.
So Sunday night, I was actually having dinner at my home. We were not watching the Golden Globes, though, which was interesting because I almost felt like, and I asked other people if they were watching, and they were like, I know the two of you were watching, you know, because the whole conversation around Golden Globes, award seasons, race, the Me Too movement. Of course, there was Spider-Man, the movie with the central character being an Afro-Boricua.
My name is Miles Morales. I was bitten by a radioactive spider, and for like 2 days, I've been the one and only Spider-Man.
Won an award. Roma.
Estamos solas. No importa lo que te digan. Siempre estamos solas.
Got Best Director and Best Foreign Film. The amazing Sandra Oh became the first woman of Asian descent to host an award show.
If I could take a moment here, in all honesty, I said yes to the fear of being on this stage tonight because I wanted to be here to look out into this audience and witness this moment of change. And I'm not fooling myself. I'm not fooling myself. Next year could be different. It probably will be. But right now, this moment is real.
Oh, God, that's so cool. She got to win Best Actress for a dramatic series. There was some bittersweet kind of aftertaste, though. So, Van, starting with you, how was your feeling about the Golden Globes and kind of the upcoming awards season in terms of real progress around gender and racial equality in Hollywood or not?
So being in interested in this stuff for some time, I've learned a long time ago to never really take the awards all that seriously.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a film like The Green Book, which I hate to rag on.
But you will.
But
you
I'm
will.
Rag on it.
Here it comes.
When it's part of this collection of movies that's leading the field, when you have all the people up there winning the award on it, and they've got all the three black people, including the one of the producers of the film over in the corner.
You saw the pan?
Yeah, the pan.
Whoever is listening to this, just go and look at the beautiful pan from left to right. Literally, the three people of color are all the way to the right-hand side when they're on the stage. I'm not making this up.
And they're all together in a little corner.
Oh, God.
It's a terrible movie. All of the fuzzy feeling that I had over Spider-Man, which I absolutely loved, over some other, I think, pieces of art that were helmed by people of color, that had great people of color in them and creatives involved in them. It just, The Green Book killed it. That movie alone killed it for me. It's like watching Crash. you remember the movie Crash back in the day. It's just such a super saccharine, we defeated racism by what this white man teaching this singer how to eat fried chicken. And it's just, that was a huge insult to, I think, common sense and to everything we've learned about race and racism over the past couple years. You got this buddy movie that the family of the subject says is totally inaccurate.
Yeah.
You know, you've got all these problems with
it. And Mahershala Ali, who is probably going to win or is definitely going to get nominated, has apologized to the family.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And I just don't know. Yeah. It's rough. And that tells me we're going to keep making these damn movies until the wheels fall off. And it doesn't seem like the wheels are going to fall off anytime soon.
Wash.
But I think, you know, Sandra Oh did say something very on point. She goes, I don't know how it's going to be next year.
Yeah.
And she's been in this business a long time. And she just took that moment to celebrate and acknowledge this rare moment of a representative, entertainment body in front of her, which looks like America, but oftentimes does not get the shot. And, you know, you guys know I've worn many hats. I've had a hat where I did a HBO pilot, and I still, you know, do some Hollywood interviews and meetings. And the conversations that I have to this day, it's painful, right? They tokenize us, the way they look at us, the narratives that they promote about us. And the reason that this keeps happening and what Van keeps saying, right? The Green Book effect, the Crash effect, the Bohemian Rhapsody effect, like the two worst movies won yesterday. That thankfully is not going to happen on the Oscars, I hope, is because even though we're out in front and even though there's more diversity, we're still not the gatekeepers. We're still not the people behind the scenes. We're still not the wizards. We're not the producers, the big-time agents, the big-time directors. There's a few of them, like Shonda Rhimes. Okay, great. But still, until we get to that equal place and setting of power, and as cultural gatekeepers, we're still going to keep seeing, yes, Sandra Oh wins, and she hosts, and Green Book wins Best Picture.
So let's move on to our final segment, which we call Binge-Worthy. Basically, what are you binging on?
So what's something that you have watched, read, listened to, even, I don't know, a piece of journalism, a Twitter feed that you are like kind of binging on? Fan, we'll start with you.
I'm going to say something really weird, and I hope you all don't judge me.
There's no judgment here.
Fan, you're part of the family. We expect weird.
It's a Twitter feed.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's called Census Americans. I forget who put it together. It's a news outlet put it together. They take these profiles of people who have filled out the census and they condense them to 280 character tweets. And basically, one at a time, they tweet out the little life summaries of these people who filled out the census. Sounds boring as hell. I guess it kind of is.
Not for Maria. I know how Maria thinks about this. She is so geeking out at what you're saying right now.
I'm defending the weirdness in advance, but if you read it, I really think it's an antidote. Anybody who is out there thinking, you know, who is putting together stories of meeting Trump voters in a diner somewhere, or you know, who is putting all these random stories of made up Americans out there. This is a compilation of real lived lives. And each one is a separate one. For me, it's like I wake up in the morning and read one, and it kind of just anchors me back on planet Earth. And regardless of whatever weird shit's happening in the news, I look at Census Americans, and I see, you know, these are the people who are going to be consuming and experiencing and having politics done to them. And that's, I think, a really... again, grounding experience.
Dude, I created a television series called America by the Numbers precisely to basically tell these stories and say it's not about numbers, it's about stories. Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to say to that, Van, is you know how the way I feel is just getting in the New York City subway or a bus, and I'm just like, damn, 8 million people from all over the world and we're all figuring it out. Okay, Waj, what's your binge-worthy?
Yeah, so four quick things, and I'm going to take it lighthearted after Van's sobering serious nerdy
that wasn't
take.
Sobering.
Oh, but let's just stop for a second and acknowledge the fact that Van just like shook our world.
Yeah, he's an all star.
Go ahead, Wash.
The whole time, like, I have to unleash some like old school poetry right now to like, or like something really deep because what I'm about to give you is pure, like, just, you know, going from the Golden Globes into binge. I was gonna end on a lighthearted note, as I actually don't have time to see anything because I have kids. So I saw Killing Eve, starring Sandra Oh, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Very enjoyable, very well acted. My son wants to play video games with me now, so I'm playing God of War, which is a brilliant game. Warriors basketball takes up way too much of my time. I'm binging on that. And finally, I made a vow in 2019, but I know I'm going to fail. I still follow Trumpism because I take him literally and seriously. And so I still find myself every day looking at his Twitter feed, seeing what he's saying, and trying my best not to become numb to it or to normalize it or to just pass it off as a joke. And I think people need to take him seriously because he is still the president of the United States of America, the commander-in-chief. And as we said before, the Overton window of what was considered acceptable or unacceptable has shifted dramatically. And he's going to get worse this year.
Oh, damn. Jesus. On that upbeat tone there, thank you, Rajahat Ali, contributor to the New York Times, and an all-star, and to a new all-star after just his very first visit, Van Newkirk, staff writer at The Atlantic. We loved having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on In the Thick.
Thanks. Thank you, guys. Send this to my grandma.
Yay!
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Dear listener, I've said this maybe once or twice before, but we'd love you to do us a favor.
Yes.
Can you go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us? Pretty please. Really, really helps us. Also, I know, do you like that voice, huh? Sounds like a mom voice, like I'm about to ask you to do something for us.
Yeah, mom, I'm going to totally rate and review this show, like, immediately.
Also, hey, you know, you can listen to In the Thick now on Pandora, on Spotify, and wherever you get your podcast. So tell everyone that you know. And follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show, and like us on Facebook. In the Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnham and Nicole Rothwell. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our intern is Lidia Hernandez Tapia. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain ZZK Records. We will see you on our next episode of In the Thick on this Friday. Thank you, dear listener, for listening.
Ciao.
Ciao. Adios. All right, listen, you guys. I'm only rushing you guys because we've only got 15 more minutes in that studio, and then they're going to kick you out and you guys become pumpkins. But listen.
I'll record for McDonald's.
You're so sweet. We love that.